Hello and welcome to Dealcast. I'm Juliana Needham. Today we're diving into a moment of real change in global merger control. Two of the world's most influential competition agencies, the European Commission and the UK's Competition and Markets Authority, are reshaping how they think about deals. Both agencies emphasise clarity, predictability and growth, yet their shifting approaches are under scrutiny, with policymakers weighing openness to private investment against strategic priorities across industrial resilience, foreign direct investment screening and defence. So what does it all mean for cross-border transactions and how can corporates make the most of the opportunities heralded by these changes? In this episode, Merger Market Global Commentary Editor John West is joined by A&O Shearman's Chemicals and Industrials Lead and Antitrust Partner James Weber, whose practice sits at the intersection of industrial strategy, competition doctrine and real-world dealmaking.
James, thank you so much for joining us. This is quite a pivotal moment, really, because you've got the European Commission horizontal and non-horizontal merger guidelines expected in the spring. And we've just, in the last week, had proposals for a shake-up of how the CMA is structured in the UK. Let's take Brussels first. The Executive Vice President and Competition Chief, Teresa Ribera, told Merger Market last month that she's looking to provide positive guidance to parties, and she's thinking in what cases, under which conditions can we provide that positive guidance. The EC says that it wants to be seen as predictable and transparent, but there are sort of underlying policy tensions, and we'll get deeper into those. But James, when you hear about Ribera discussing positive guidance, do you think that that's a genuine shift towards clarity for parties or more of a sort of signaling exercise?
So I think the first thing is you would expect her to say that. So in her job, she's not going to come out and say, I want it to be unpredictable and opaque, right? So she sort of has to say that. I think in their ideal world, in the European Commission and in the CMA, in fact, any competition authority, their ideal world is to be left alone, to get on with the job as they see it, using a well-understood consumer welfare framework and apply the evidence, you know, as best they can for the cases that come before them, right? And they're under significant pressure now to, and that pressure's been building over the last few years, to look at all sorts of incremental different things within the competition framework around resilience, of course, most prominently, but also, you know, labour effects and wider industrial policy effects, defence considerations. And so, you know, they have a very difficult job now of trying to come up with an intellectually coherent framework to think about those issues in a merger control context. So, you know, my bet as to what's going to happen is that the guidelines that they're drafting will end up having a bit of something for everyone.
Is it going to be typical Brussels fudge?
I'm afraid it probably will be. You know, you'll find a bit in the guidance which talks about resilience and talks about the importance of avoiding single points of failure and keeping productive capacity in Europe. And then you will also have bits in respect of market power, for example, that could be called upon, you know, to resist mergers that consolidate European industrial production.
Yeah, and those two elements might not even be written by the same person. I guess that's the issue.
Well, exactly.
You mentioned consumer welfare there, James. Now, it's interesting, isn't it? Because that weighs against quite reasonable impulses that the Commission has on industrial resilience, defence, cybersecurity, etc., etc. Let's take an example, because there was an example back in 2019 where the Commission blocked the Tata Steel ThyssenKrupp deal. And that's a bit of a kind of that's a bit of a lodestar, really, in the sense that many at the time were arguing that that kind of merger, that kind of consolidation, was necessary to aid and support Europe's beleaguered steel industry. It was blocked on those consumer welfare grounds. Is there going to be a shift towards more accommodation of champions emerging in Europe in order to build that resilience?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great example to choose because it's extremely awkward for the Commission, right? So you stop a merger in 2019, and then we have the real life experiment play out subsequently, right? The implicit in blocking that merger is that you think competition is going to continue between Tata and ThyssenKrupp. I wasn't involved in the transaction for either party, by the way. But implicit in the block is that competition between the two of them is important. And yet, play it forward a few years, and ThyssenKrupp especially has announced closures of multiple plants, entering into sort of quite complicated agreements with its unions, but that revolve around shutdowns or mothballing, etc. But capacity has left the market. Capacity that was supposed to be that head-to-head competition, delivering low prices for consumers, has left the market and has effectively been replaced by imports, which was essentially the defence that was offered in that case. And so what does the Commission say to that? You know, oops, right? Would be the capacity's left the market anyway, been replaced by imports. The block of the merger block was a mistake. I think the more sympathetic view would be that, well, the issue was in a particular type of steel. The automakers, it's widely thought, were the principal complainants. They're the consumers that were worried about this transaction. And maybe for the type of steel that they were looking to acquire, you know, the closures don't affect that. But I think ultimately, you know, that's a great example of applying the traditional framework, looking at capacity competition between two players and saying removal of that capacity will result in an increase in price. Therefore, we're going to block the transaction. And over time, that proving to be wrong, right? What's actually happened is Europe's lost the industrial capacity anyway, and imports have increased as a share of total demand.
And within that consumer welfare framework, there's also this concept of pivotality when a merged entity becomes pivotal, that and rivals cannot meet total demand, and therefore that the kind of merged entity would become so critical to a particular market. That's sort of within this consumer welfare framework. But again, it's potentially quite unhelpful for the consolidation of sectors that require it, right?
Absolutely. I think it's also fair to say it's pretty ambiguous within consumer welfare as well, right? Pivotality as an idea is the thought that if the merging parties are still necessary to meet any portion of demand in an industrial homogenous product, then they will still have the ability to set the marginal price because some customers will have to acquire from them. And if that price is raised, other people in the market won't use their spare capacity to win further share, they will enjoy the higher price, the higher clearing price on their existing output. But that's a economically ambiguous question, right? It does depend market by market as to how everyone else in the marketplace reacts. So even on a traditional consumer welfare standard, you could say the pivotality as a rule, as a yardstick for deciding whether someone has market power or not is debatable, right? Or it's even within consumer welfare. But certainly, if you think about what does that mean for resilience, it would mean, in theory, that there would have to be so much European spare capacity to allow a European consolidation as to be unrealistic.
Yeah, I mean, it seems to assume a sort of uneconomic level of spare capacity within each industry at a point where Europe is grappling with a competitiveness crisis.
Well, that's right. And you've got, you know, the central problem is capacity which is underutilized today, right? You're not getting European industrial capacity up to full output because, you know, the fixed costs are too high, spread over insufficient output because the output is having to compete with low cost imports and also structurally lower demand in certain sectors. The whole rationale for the merger is to take out excess capacity and make what's left more efficient. Right. And of course, if you think of the world through a sort of pivotality lens, if that's how you think about market power, it's going to make those transactions much more difficult to do.
So would you anticipate that the new rules coming through would maybe shift the pivotality argument or perhaps bench it?
I think it's probably going to end up in there. It's this idea that the guidelines will end up with something for everyone. Now, pivotality is not brand new,
right?
So it's making an appearance in the guidelines, but it's reflecting practice that we've seen in a few cases before. I mean, Tata ThyssenKrupp is a prominent example of it, but older than that, ArcelorMittal Ilva, also a steel case, also used that concept. Celanese Blackstone used it as well too. So it's been around in the ether for a while. It's just not been in the guidelines. And one of the goals of the guidelines was to capture these concepts that have been adopted by cases and decisions and sort of concretize them and put them in the guidance. So, you know, that's where it came from. It's been there a while, but now it appears in the guidance. It's likely to be something that they refer to as a factor, right, that suggests market power. And that leads to this thing, this uncertainty problem, because you've got a chapter of the guidance you could look at and say, okay, this chapter would suggest that we would lead towards interventional prohibition. And then there's going to be new chapters about the importance of retaining European industrial ecosystem or resilience, which says you should permit this merger, right? You know, you've got a sort of intellectual incoherence playing out live in the sort of Eurofudge, as it were. And so the uncertainty will come from parties and advisors not knowing which of those paragraphs are going to be cut and pasted into the eventual decision.
Exactly. And to go into, you know, you're obviously a chemicals lead for A&O Shearman. So it's a very timely moment to be discussing the Aequitor deals, two of them, buying out the LyondellBasell and SABIC European petrochemicals assets. That's a pretty hefty consolidation. And it's one you've been involved with on the SABIC side, I believe. I guess you were talking about parties not knowing necessarily how to approach this kind of question of how their mergers will be treated through the pivotality lens. Do you think that sort of consolidation within, say, petrochemicals, another sector that has been impacted by a flood of Chinese imports, are we going to see more of those? And is that, you say about the rules having sort of, you're able to cherry pick which rule you decide to apply from within the new guidelines. Is there going to be a little more accommodation of those kinds of mergers to get critical industries to the scale they need?
Yeah, I mean, we'll see, I think, is the answer to that. I mean, obviously can't talk about the SABIC one especially, but I think when you're counseling clients more generally, you're looking at the traditional theory of harm, you know, where is the current buyer, you know, where is the buyer, what are the overlaps? And then you're also trying to think, you know, what is the real life evidence of imports and the competitive pressure that comes from imports? And in markets like chemicals and frankly steel and numerous other places, that evidence is pretty abundant. So is the right framework purely European domestic production? Or do you have to say, you know, look, the real constraint, the marginal cost is being set by imports. And the trade defense instruments which are in place are not in practice deferring those imports or discouraging them. So, you know, they are a real constraint. And how do you want to look at that, Commission, right? Whether you look at it as part of the market, sort of traditionally the geographic market expands to incorporate them, or whether you look at them as a out of market constraint, the real world is that imports are making all of the difference.
This might be a useful moment to just sort of branch into where the Commission has seemed to adopt some novel practice, because we're talking about the traditional approach to things and how that's shifting. One example of how their practice appears to be shifting is the incredible launching of an in-depth investigation into Anglo-American offloading its ferronickel assets to MMG. MMG, of course, is Hong Kong listed, but majority owned by Chinamin Metals, which is a state-owned enterprise. And it's particular, you know, the assets under question are not within the European Union. They're largely, I believe, Brazilian. Ferronickel is relatively abundant, and yet they seem to be calling that in through the kind of prism of resilience and supply chains into Europe. That feels quite different. Did it strike you as
anyone who looked at nickel, right, in the last 10 years would not have said that Anglo-American was a core player, right? You've got players that are many times larger than that. And Nornickel, Vale, most obviously the Chinese players, etc. They seem to have got there by taking a ferronickel and then saying it's low carbon ferronickel, and that's how we generate a market share that's large enough to justify a phase two merger. I think that it does represent a sea change. I don't think that that would have happened a few years ago. And the real reason, and if you look at the remedy negotiations that are on, you know, that have been mentioned in publicly, you know, they're looking at preserving supply to European steelmakers, which then the underlying theory seems, stainless steelmakers, the underlying theory seems to be that China, for non-economic reasons, might divert that material away from Europe, right, for supply dependency reasons. And you there you've got a kind of industrial policy, industrial ecosystem resilience concern in a kind of antitrust wrapper. And sort of the and it feels like, I don't know, feels like that the market definition has followed the industrial policy concern to get to that, so that they can get to it. And that's a real example of the new world, I think.
So if we've got this new emerging approach to do with resilience layered on top of a traditional consumer welfare practice, layered on top of industrial strategy impetus that is looking to build European champions, and you're saying that the guidelines are likely to emerge as having something for everyone, what then is within the art of the possible for deal makers? You know, is it going to be earlier engagement with DG Comp? Is it going to be refining the strategic narrative of your deals in order to win over the sort of political favor? How should corporates and advisors approach this moment?
I think you definitely need to do all of that. Right. So to a greater extent that you have done now, you need to be mindful of the politics. What are the strategic or strategic autonomy type drivers that sit behind the transaction? And to be able to articulate those. Now, you probably have to articulate them anyway, because a lot of transactions will have FDI review in Europe. And that's, of course, explicitly political. Right. And so you're kind of doing that now anyway, right? The MMG Anglo-American is unusual because, as you said, the assets aren't in Europe, and so there isn't any European FDI sort of component to it. The antitrust is the only nexus for any of this stuff to happen. So I think when you're planning a deal, you're already thinking about how do you get FDI, and all of those issues are really live anyway. So you're kind of doing that work in the first place.
How much of the FDI screening is really done at the EC level? Because
none. Right. The FDI stuff all happens at member state level. Although, I mean, there are coordination tools, but fundamentally, that decision sits at the member states, and it's also very black boxed. Right, so quite why things turn out as they do is often unclear. Right, there's no reasoned decisions, for example. But if you go back to your point, you know, what could you deal makers do? Like when you, let's say you're doing the politics anyway for FDI purposes. So what incrementally can you do now as a result of the guidelines? I think if you're going to run resilience arguments and you're going to run essentially counterfactual arguments to say, if you don't clear this, you will lose the industrial capacity, right? Which is perhaps not a full failing firm type argument, but is a sort of strategic argument. The best way to win on that is to get customers to agree with you, right? If they agree, if they see the world the same way, if they see imports as the constraint, if they want local domestic production to be an alternative to Chinese imports because they could be here today, gone tomorrow, then they ought to agree with you.
So it's sort of a move away from pivotality to criticality in terms of sector arguments.
I would say the primary audience for your advocacy really ought to be, you know, your customers, because if they then play that into the regulators, you're in a good place, right? The problem comes where customers say, this is nonsense, right? I am playing AF against B. You know, China is here, it comes and goes, Russia comes and goes. You know, these are the two people who compete for my business in Europe, right? If your customers are saying that, then you've got a steep hill to climb.
Now, let's shift slightly, because while Brussels is engaged in something of a philosophical debate about its approach to merger control, this side of the channel, here in London, the UK government has pushed for another reset of the structural basis of the Competition and Markets Authority. This is quite striking because, obviously, the Labour government has already undertaken a strategic reset. They gave a strategic steer to the CMA in early 2025. And that seemed to create quite a lot of goodwill, a rare example of goodwill from the city as to the government's agenda. And yet they're pressing the button again. Let's just roll back. Why did the government want to make that strategic steer in early 2025? It was really a response to the 2023 blocking of Microsoft Activision and the drama that went with that, right?
Undoubtedly. I mean, that was a sobering episode for all of us. In the post-Brexit world, the CMA had attended all sorts of grand panels and had carved a path for itself as the kind of third big name in antitrust, alongside the European Commission and the US, and that was helping with its self-confidence. It was helping with hiring staff, frankly, right? Because you could put yourself at the forefront of antitrust policy and be really highly relevant. And then along came Microsoft Activision, and it all turned out to be, as I said, sobering, let's say.
And there was a lot of political blowback for the Sunak administration at the time, as I recall.
Yeah, there was. And that really flushed out this gap between sort of the political accountability that the leadership of the CMA have. You know, they're the ones who have to lift the phone if the Chancellor calls, whether he did or didn't. And they're the ones who have to appear before the select committees and stuff. And the panel, right, which is just making the decision, but the CMA's leadership is not formally and actually involved in it, right? So that sort of accountability gap, as it were, really shone out brightly as a result of that episode, and caused an awful lot of thinking.
And I suppose the reset in the strategic steer at the beginning of 2025 didn't really deal with that accountability question. So, obviously they wanted to improve.
That's what we're seeing now.
Right. So let's fast forward. Obviously, we've got the four P's in place now: predictability, proportionality, pace, process. It seems that we've even spoken to chief legal officers of companies who said that their phase two investigation was a breeze and a delight and a pleasure, which we would never have heard in the prior sort of regime. But this latest set of proposals in 2026 is going to upend that again. The panel structure that you just talked about is facing serious change. Talk us through that.
Yeah, I think the premise of your point is right. The four P's reforms have gone down really well, right? Very few people have got critical things to say about that. They presented a really important set of and thoughtful improvements to the way that the existing regime worked inside the legislation, especially to phase two. Much higher levels of engagement, much higher levels of using the hearings properly as hearings.
We've heard of panel site visits to plants and so on and so forth. Real engagement.
There were always site visits, but that here they've now got rid of a few bits of paper in the process, and you've got explicit elements of sort of teach-ins and engagement with the panel is much higher than it used to be. So that is all almost universally accepted as a positive. The structural reforms which came out last week are very odd, frankly, right? I mean, the consultation itself is odd, right? Like you are proposing legislative changes to the regime, and the British regime for competition is an eccentric one anyway, right? Internationally, for lots of reasons, and it's complicated, and it's a creature of its own history. And rather than the consultation coming out and saying, well, that we have the panel system at the moment, we're thinking of changing it because of we don't have this political accountability for the decisions it makes, but you know, these are the pros and cons. This is sort of the impact assessment, as it were. These are the three or four alternatives to the panel system, and sort of consulting openly on that, even with a recommendation as to which way they're leaning. You know, but that's not what the consultation is. I mean, it basically looks like a decision already made.
It looks like a fait accompli.
It does look like that. And the reaction has been quite negative.
For those listeners who aren't necessarily aware, that they're talking about essentially abolishing the current panel system in favour of some subcommittees, which would still have external presence and industry experts, apparently, although that's rather nebulously handled in the consultation document, but on which CMA executives would sit, so that if they are called to a select committee or they do have to do the media round, they will have been in the room for the decisions they've made. That accountability element isn't necessarily a bad thing, right?
No. You can make a case to say that, well, the European regime, the criticism of the CMA and political interference is unfair, right? The European regime, we sometimes forget, is explicitly political. The decision is made by either the Commission as a college or as the European Commissioner for Competition Policy, who is a politician, right? Who, by the way, might know nothing at all about competition policy as a kind of, you know, political academic background. And so what's wrong with having, I suppose, the CMA leadership who are a political appointee sort of being accountable to Parliament and government for the decisions that they make? Like, it doesn't sound that weird. But I think in a, you know, what's sort of, what it's flushed out, lots of people have made these points as well, right? That it may harm the timeliness of decisions in a counterintuitive way, because the subcommittee of the board, now, how long will it take to teach that subcommittee about the transaction? How long, you know, will that subcommittee act as the current panel does, right, in terms of all of the things we're just talking about and engagement with the parties and learning, etc.?
Predictability is one of the four P's. So if you're concerned about the composition of the panel, whether it would kind of act in a predictable way or in the way that the CMA has, certainly for the last 12 months, you've got a problem.
Yes. If you expect the board, you know, alongside all of its existing role to, or a subcommittee of the board even, to make those decisions, are they going to be timely and are they going to be evidence-based? Or are they basically going to be crammed down? Because if they're crammed down, then you end up either following the views of the staff, which effectively is a pointless exercise. You might as well just let the staff make the decision themselves. Or the board end up following sort of vibes. And so you lose one of the central due process protections that the UK regime does have, which is this independent panel, and you make the board capture, or vulnerable to capture, right, by firms and by government.
It's fair to say that there's a high degree of regard in the industry for the CEO, Sarah Cardell, right?
Well, that's one of the dangers, because there undoubtedly is very high regard for Sarah, and not just Sarah, but like many other people in the leadership of the CMA. But setting up a bad process puts good people in a very difficult position. If you have a system which is overly dependent on what I think The Economist at various points has described as the good chap theory of government, that when those staff change, when the system is under pressure under different political leadership or under different actual leadership of the CMA, you know, you realize that the system, the checks and balances in the system just aren't there. And that is hugely damaging to predictability of outcomes and also investment, right? Because one thing investors want, you know, the sort of people I work for and lots of other people like me work for, they want, you know, due process plays into your investment decision, right? You might be prepared to take a gamble on a merger outcome if you can be reasonably advised as to its prospects, but also you're going to have a fair chance to fight your case, right, ideally in front of an independent decision maker. And most people, especially American companies, the human beings are incapable of both prosecuting and fairly deciding their own case. It's just too difficult. And so I think this reform is starting to flush out lots of quite complicated criticism, which says, actually, is this the moment to say the whole thing has got too over-engineered, too complicated, too full of its own contradictions? And we'd be better thinking from the ground up to think, for example, do we go to a court-based prosecutorial model like America has, where the CMA is prosecutor?
So the CMA would lead investigations, it would have a prosecutorial format, it would be able to go to the court, but the court would make the decision.
Exactly. And there's lots of problems with that. But one of the big advantages is everyone knows what role they are, and the political accountability is crystal clear. The CMA can be as political as they like.
Right.
In their enforcement priorities, in the cases that they choose to prosecute, in the way in which they choose to prosecute it, they can go on today programme and be aligned with the government till the cows come home, because the decision maker is a judge, right? And you know that everyone understands the role in the system that they play, and we may well be at the point where we have to start thinking more about along those lines.
Yes, and the danger of political interference or the increased politicisation of the appointments of CMA executives. I mean, we already saw a bit of controversy around that with the appointment of Doug Gurr, I think it is, as the interim,
yeah, right,
still interim chair of the CMA. And there was a lot of hoo-ha about that. What does this mean, though, for dealmakers, right, filing in the UK? Because there have been some good process changes. As you say, the four Ps have been well received. But this system could introduce a little more unpredictability just at a time when predictability seems to have been restored to the system. So how should dealmakers, again, that sort of art of the possible question, how should they align for this moment?
I think at the moment, it's now is not the moment to align for it. I think now the advice in respect to the UK is very, very good, right? Which is that, you know, the four Ps are real. If your deal does not have the big one that makes a difference in my experience is that if the deal doesn't have a real UK nexus, you know, if someone else has the better cited antitrust authority, right, then the CMA will listen to that to a much greater degree than they did before Microsoft Activision. And that creates, that's really valuable. The other thing you say to them is that, you know, the CMA is much more interested and much more flexible around remedy discussions. And one of the big other things that's going on is the sort of bringing forward of remedy discussions in the process more generally, and a greater openness to different remedies to solve competition problems. And that creates a greater range of possible outcomes, right? Whereas before Microsoft Activision, the CMA was very hostile to remedies, and it was kind of a block, or as a binary win or lose, you either block it or it goes through. Whereas now you've got more room in the middle to think, okay, if a problem coalesces, we can work to find a solution.
And not just structural remedies, right? Not only divestment.
No, exactly. And so that's a big improvement too. So at the moment, the advice is very, very sort of supportive of both what CMA has done and of the UK investment environment. You know, these new changes are less impressive from a sort of external investor point of view.
Now, let's just cap this all off. I was thinking 5 years ago, the landscape globally in Europe and the UK looked so different. And now we've got the abandonment of the neo-Brandeisian Biden settlement in the US. The European Union is thinking much more about industrial strategy and resilience and moved away from the Vestager capital L liberal era. And here in the UK, there's been a focus on growth and trying to speed decisions and be more growth oriented. If you think between now and 5 years ago, when you're advising executives, what is the one thing you're telling them is really different now in terms of how they approach merger control in any jurisdiction versus, say, 2020?
I think you can be much more ambitious in terms of what you're trying to achieve. I think that the system still has hard lines of steel running through it, right? Like it is difficult to merge to monopoly, right? As it should be. And so you shouldn't get too high on your own supply when you're talking about the art of the possible. But when you're thinking about transactions, there is a much wider range of argument and evidence that is open to you and that the authorities are open to hearing than there would have been historically. If you take transactions like Vodafone 3, for example, like run that back, not even 5 years, you know, and it just simply it would have been completely ridiculous to suggest that taking the parties and now already announced investment plans and saying that that amounts to a behavioral remedy for a horizontal overlap case would have not been a very successful strategy, right, to put it mildly. So, but when you get into the economics of it's beyond the scope of this, but when you get into Vodafone 3, it's not just a concession by the CMA, like it does make sense, right? You can just reasonable people can reasonably disagree as to whether it's the right judgment, but it's not crazy. So what you're saying to people is, look, let's really understand why you want to do that transaction. What is it that you're likely to generate from it? And what are the social benefits, right, in terms of the rest of the supply chain, your customers, society as a whole, right, respect to sort of, you know, resilience and employment considerations. And let's kind of put all of that together and think, you know, how do we build sort of the evidence around those arguments? Because you'd have a much greater number of levers to pull on.
So rumors of ESG's death are somewhat exaggerated then?
I think so. I mean, I think that you've got more optionality to be able to defend transactions than you had to before. The risk really is that people hear that and then they immediately go to, you know, very harmful transactions, which you still have to say, look, I'm sorry, I can't really see. That's just a straightforwardly anti-competitive transaction. I mean, I've always taken the view that someone in my job has stopped more mergers than an antitrust official ever has, because you're advising people, you know, that no, that's not going to work, right? And so you will still have that. So it's not that everything has become possible, but it's that marginal deals, which generate real benefits, efficiencies, you know, which might previously have been dismissed as outside of the narrow sort of price framework, will now get a better hearing than they had done before. And even if they don't, you'll have more flexibility in negotiating a fix.
I'm afraid that's all we have time for, but thank you so much, James.
That was Merger Markets Global Commentary Editor John West speaking to A&O Shearman's Chemicals and Industrials Lead and Antitrust Partner James Weber. Thanks for listening to this week's episode of Dealcast from Merger Markets. I'm Juliana Needham. If you've enjoyed listening, please follow the podcast on an app that supports it, and please give us a rating and review. To find out more about what we've been discussing on this episode, have a look at our show notes. Join us again next week.